Hey guys, welcome to episode 217 of the True Crime Couple podcast. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope you're all doing well. And what we want to do is jump right into the show today. But make sure that if you're new to Patreon, you're staying until the end so we can give you your personal shout out. And if you want to join Patreon for ad-free episodes and two bonus episodes a month, join at patreon.com/truecrimecouple. Okay, John, are you ready to hear something crazy?
Of course.
On December 7th, 2003, 13-year-old Daniel Morcombe decided to spend his Sunday shopping at the Sunshine Plaza to find Christmas gifts for his family. In order to get there, he would have to take a 20-minute bus ride to the location. While he waited for the bus, that he did not know was broken down, Daniel could have never guessed that a predator was lying in wait behind him, looking to take advantage of the boy's unfortunate situation.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
In December of 2003, 13-year-old Daniel Morcombe lived at 116 Woombye Palm Woods Road with his twin brother Bradley, their older brother Dean, and his parents Bruce and Denise. Their neighborhood of Palm Woods is located in the Sunshine Coast region of Queensland, which is on the country's east coast. But Palm Woods is not a coastal town. It sits in the foothills of the Blackall Range and lies 17 to 20 kilometers or 10 to 12 miles west of the coast, and is known to be a place of rural rest and relaxation for those looking to live a slower-paced life, but still have access to the amenities cities and coastal towns have to offer. It had the best of both worlds, and was, Bruce and Denise decided, the perfect place to raise their three boys. On Sunday, December 7th, Bruce had originally planned for the family to attend a Christmas function in Brisbane, which is a little over an hour's drive south. However, the boys were unable to go with them because on the weekends they worked picking passion fruits on the neighboring property. And because of the passing showers, that morning the picking had to be postponed. Bruce recalled that it had been the perfect excuse for his sons to stay back. Bruce and Denise went on their own with the understanding that the boys were going to spend the Sunday together once the picking was done. They planned to be home around 4:30 p.m. And I know it's hard for us to imagine here, and they probably think, you know, we're crazy, like obviously, but it's warm during Christmas time in Australia. So their average temperature in Palm Woods, where we're talking about, is 84 degrees in December.
I mean, that is wild. I mean, I guess it's the same thing with like people in like California, right? And people on the West Coast, but.
And that's 29 Celsius.
Okay. Well, thank you for pointing that out.
People like when I say both.
There's only one time that I use Celsius ever.
What's
and
that?
That's actually, I know you're like squinting your eyebrows, like you're wondering what I use it for, but I actually use it for when I look at my computer temperature, because for whatever reason, computers are like the input for it is automatically Celsius.
I would say the reason is that we're the only ones that use Fahrenheit and everybody else uses Celsius.
I mean, you definitely are right.
Yeah.
But I've learned a little Celsius from looking at the computer
temperature. I've dabbled in some Celsius numbers.
I've dabbled
before.
In some Celsius. Because you know what it is? It's like when I hear kilometers, I'm like, you know, damn. I'm like, don't do this to me. You know, it's like, that's just how, like, why do we do this? If we were all on the same page, that'd be great.
Apparently, we tried in the 70s to switch over, and it was disastrous.
Think about it. Celsius sounds cooler. Kilometers sounds cooler. Like, I'm down to do it.
Well, we're stubborn Americans who don't like learning new things.
Right side drive. That would be cool. Like...
No, John, that's scary, because then cars are coming at you.
Well, that's because you favor your left side, not your right side when you drive. So,
okay, you're right.
Fun fact for Kay there.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to the case.
Sorry, go ahead.
At some point in the morning, Daniel made the decision to make the trip to the Sunshine Plaza in the nearby town of Maroochydore to get a haircut and buy some Christmas presents that he planned to hide when he returned. That is so adorable.
It is.
To get there, Daniel would have to take a bus. This was not something that was uncommon for him to do. And really, I would say in 2003, it was commonplace for younger kids to take buses all the time. I mean, I know I did it too, to go to a local mall. And he usually took this trip with his twin Bradley. The two would usually catch the bus every month or so. So it was not only a walk, but an experience he was familiar with. The boys told him that they would see him when he returned, and they went about their days. Daniel left the house around 1 p.m. In order for him to get to the unofficial bus stop, located at the Keels Mountain Road underpass on the northern side of the Nambour Connection Road, it would take about 30 minutes of walking. He could just walk down his driveway and then head up north on Wumbai Palmwoods Road to get to the underpass, but it was shorter and safer to go through some properties and walk down the Nambour Connection Road. And this was the path that he took. From there, the bus ride to the shopping plaza would only be a 20-minute ride. So in total, the trip to get there should have only taken under an hour.
And I'm sorry, how old was he?
13.
Okay.
The bus was scheduled to arrive at the stop a little after 1:30 p.m. However, unbeknownst to Daniel, the bus that was supposed to have picked him up broke down about 750 meters before the overpass. A replacement bus had been sent, but because the service was late, the decision had been made to run the replacement bus as an express shuttle to the Sunshine Plaza, with plans to send a smaller shuttle bus to pick up the remaining passengers who waited on the route, like Daniel. Now, of course, Daniel did not know this. So when the replacement bus passed him at 2:15 p.m., he hailed for it to stop. The driver of that bus made a signal to him that signified another bus would be coming along to pick him up, but that he had been instructed to go forward.
Let's be honest. If you have time as a bus driver to signal that another bus is coming to a 13-year-old child waiting at a bus stop, you know, I think you could just stop and just let the kid get on. I'm going to be honest.
Okay. Well, it's easy to say that, right? And of course, we all want that to happen because we feel bad for this 13-year-old boy. But the reason why they didn't stop was because the bus was running really behind. So if you think about it, the bus was scheduled to be there at 1:30 and this bus passes at 2:15. So it's already 45 minutes behind and some people have to get to work. So everyone who was waiting on that broke down bus and like sweating in the heat, they decided to just shuttle directly there instead of continuing to stop because it was more convenient and nice to them for having to wait. And the shuttle bus was literally right behind this bus. It's not like he had to wait a long amount of time.
Okay. I know what you mean. As long as he wasn't waiting too long. But I'm just saying, if I'm the bus driver, I'm stopping. I think I could say that. It's not like, oh, in retrospect, like it's like, no. It sounds like the bus's problem. It doesn't sound like the kid's problem. You know what I mean?
I agree.
See a kid there, you just stop the bus and let him get on.
No, I trust me. I agree. And wait till you hear what happens. Because I know what you're saying, and I'm thinking the same thing. Because when I was reading the case, I was like, well, that's a screwed up thing to do. Like, just pick everybody up. It doesn't make sense. But that's supposedly the protocol of what happens when a bus breaks down.
Well, let's hope they change their protocol. But continue.
Well, let's get into it.
Okay.
So it was not just the bus driver that saw 13-year-old Daniel waiting at the stop, wearing navy blue long shorts, a red Billabong t-shirt, and gray Globe brand sneakers. The passengers on the bus saw him as well. And they also saw that the boy was not alone. Accounts varied, but they all had one detail in common. There had been an adult man standing behind Daniel. Now, some of the accounts said that there was also a second man there who was standing next to an older model blue boxy sedan. And other accounts included that they also saw a white van nearby. But again, every account included the detail that there was one man standing behind the 13-year-old boy. The shuttle bus that had been sent to pick up the remaining people that waited for the bus to the Sunshine Plaza came only 3 minutes after the replacement bus had passed. So at 2:18, the bus passed. But by then, Daniel was already gone. And so was the man who stood behind him.
Within 3 minutes. I mean, I guess that's really all it takes. Okay, I see where this is going.
Bruce and Denise got home around 4:30 p.m. As I said before, the couple was unaware that their boys would be splitting up for the day. So they were concerned when they learned that Daniel had ventured out to the Sunshine Plaza by himself and had not yet returned. Denise assumed that Daniel would be making his way home shortly because of the fact that the bus routes were shorter on Sundays and because Daniel informed his brothers that he would be home around that time. So she drove to the bus stop so he wouldn't have to walk the 30 minutes home. However, when she got there, there was no sign of him. She had passed the broken down bus before the underpass bus stop that was still there from the breakdown earlier in the afternoon. So when Denise returned home, she told her husband that Daniel hadn't been at the stop, but that one of the buses broke down. So maybe, she was just trying to guess what was happening here, maybe the timetables for all the buses had been affected because of the breakdown. And the timetables just means, refers to when the buses are getting to which stop.
It's so crazy how in this story, it's just a small detail of a bus breaking down and them having to revert, you know, certain things and try to make up for it as the reason as to why he's missing right now.
Right. Isn't such a tragedy would happen because of such innocuous detail?
It's crazy. Like, I've never really thought about it like that. Yeah, like one little detail, the parents are unaware.
Change the course of your entire life.
Yeah, like the parents are unaware of a bus being broken down. And also he doesn't know.
They're unaware of when this bus broke down.
Right.
Because it makes sense that they would assume this breakdown happened a little bit later on. Because this bus broke down and was waiting there for a really long time. If it was there when Denise is going to pass at 4:30.
It's crazy.
And I think that it goes to show that a lot of criminals act impulsively and they seek out opportunities and they take them when they can. And that's a terrifying thought. So under the impression that the timetables might be off, Bruce agreed with his wife and decided to go back to the Keels Mountain underpass at 5:30 p.m. But Daniel was not there at that time either. He went back home just in case he had made his way home, and the two had missed each other. But their 13-year-old son still was not home. Denise went online and checked the timetables of the buses. The family was horrified to learn that the last bus had been scheduled to leave the Sunshine Plaza at 5 p.m. So if Daniel was not home yet, it meant that he either missed the bus or something had happened to him. The couple instructed their sons to stay home in case Daniel returned, and they made the drive to the Sunshine Plaza in Maroochydore to see if maybe he had just missed the bus. When they got there, they could not find him, but they did see a bus driver who they stopped and asked questions about the timetable to. He confirmed that the last bus that had left the plaza did so at 5 past 5. Now, if you remember, it's only a 20-minute drive back to that bus stop. So then he definitely should have been there when his father went to go look for him. But he had not been. The couple, now in a complete panic, drove back home praying that Daniel was there. He was not. And the Morecambes called 000. To report their son missing. Police response was immediate. An APB for Daniel went out immediately. And while they could, as the nighttime approached, they searched the area from where Daniel would have walked from his home to the bus stop and in surrounding bushland areas. The report included pictures of the boy and a description of what he had been wearing at the time of his disappearance. But efforts were limited as the sun went down on the Sunshine Coast. Okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to take a break to talk about the first sponsor of today's show, Uncommon Goods. The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. On Uncommon Goods, I was able to find the perfect gift for my friend who loves to read. The DIY Dream Library Bookend Kit. It will be the perfect addition to her beautiful library, and I know it'll make her feel seen this Christmas. And it was something I never even thought about getting until I saw it on the website. That's what Uncommon Goods does. You just scroll through and gifts just scream out at you in the names of the loved ones that they were intended for. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/TCC. That's uncommongoods.com/TCC for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. Okay, let's get back to the show. The following morning, pictures of Daniel were released to the media. Because he had gone missing in such a high traffic area, he was basically waiting on the side of a highway. The investigators knew that someone had to have seen him. So the description was given that the boy had plans to go to the underpass bus stop, and had anyone seen him? As tips poured in, investigators spoke to the bus drivers about what they had seen. They learned from the driver of the express replacement bus that Daniel had been at the bus stop and flagged him down, but he had signaled that another bus would be on its way shortly. And you can only imagine how that man felt.
Probably really guilty, like he probably should have stopped. And you know what? I will say, it, so far, the investigation process, I'm pleased with it. Because they're kind of going right into action.
Yes, the response is, like I said, immediate. And I think that they are going to do the right thing to reach out to the media because there's a lot of people traveling. You're talking about a weekend in December. So people are going to be out and about shopping, trying to do different things. Appealing to the public, I think, was the smartest thing for them to do early on in this investigation.
Yeah. My only concern is we know what happens to children who are abducted, that there is a potentiality that, you know, they're not usually kept alive long.
Yes.
And that is something to consider here, which I'm sure investigators, police are privy to.
Right. And that's why they acted so quickly.
Yeah.
Because that window is incredibly short. The statistic I know is that within the first 3 hours of an abducted child going missing, 74% of them are murdered within that time frame.
I mean, that is an extremely high statistic and a very short amount of time as well.
I agree. And that's a horrible thing for the family to learn and have to have in the back of their mind as they're trying to hold out hope in their searches. So the calls that came in to investigators varied, as I said before. Some of them said they saw two men, one by a blue car and one behind Daniel, and others included a white van parked nearby. A few witnesses stated that while Daniel waited for the bus near the edge of the busy road, the man that was behind him was set a good distance back. He leaned against the wall of the overpass, with one leg bent against the wall and the other straight on the ground. Everyone said, though, that this man that was standing behind Daniel was looking directly at the back of him. Even though stranger abductions are rare, this unfortunately looked right away like an abduction because of the presence of a man or men at the scene and a vehicle for them to have left in. And Daniel having disappeared just 3 minutes after he was last seen, not just by the driver of the express bus, but also its passengers. There were no calls that came in from anyone claiming to have seen Daniel get in the vehicle or walking away with a male figure, however. The eerie circumstances of this case put investigators into high gear because it meant Daniel was in serious danger. They needed to find out who this man was. Houses and businesses were canvassed around Daniel's house, and the route he would have taken to get to the stop and the places near where the stop was. All the while, the physical search for Daniel yielded no clues as to what could have happened to him. The investigation at this point took two routes. First, the public-facing one, which included the blasting out of information about Daniel and the circumstances of his disappearance. A press conference was set up with Bruce and Denise, where they pleaded for their son's return or any information anyone had about that day. The police expressed that they were anxious to speak with this man or men that had been around the bus stop with Daniel that day. You know, and they kind of made it clear, we just want to talk to you. So like, if you turn yourself in and say, oh, that was me, we're not going to immediately suspect you. We want to know what your perspective of that day is. So they were making it like a welcoming turn in.
Right. Which I think is the right way to approach it, because you don't want to be found somehow responsible just because you were there at the bus stop next to a child. But like some of the people who saw these two men, you know, sometimes body language is everything, you know? And I think that when someone is looking, like someone's looking at that happening, right? I feel like you can tell someone's intentions on their body language.
Right. It just seemed like he was this guy from the description they give, calm, cool, collected, standing a little bit back away from this kid, looking cool, right, if I can say that, trying to appear harmless to a 13-year-old boy.
Right, and that's how you would do it, because the last thing you're going to do is stand there looking menacing. I mean, come on, you're not going to do that.
Right, because he'll be like, get away from me, weirdo.
Exactly.
Trust me, I've been around 13-year-old boys for 13 years.
Yeah, so, which tells me that there has, whoever did this has done it before, because that's not just something that you can do. To be calm, cool, and collected, and you know what you're about to do, that just shows that you've done it before. And I think they're looking for someone that could potentially have a record.
Right. I think that's a good point to make, and to have done it in 3 minutes.
Yeah, because you're not going to be super stoic like that and get away with it in 3 minutes. Yeah. That's out in the open, by the way.
That's a very bold move.
It is bold. We're not talking about like some secluded alley. We're talking about a bus stop.
Right, and I don't think that would be the actions of someone who this is their first offense. I think you're correct in thinking that.
Right.
So the investigators knew that this public-facing part of the investigation was important, because the only clues they were going to find were from what people had observed that day. The missing posters and the media blast of information was constant. And it wasn't long before everyone in Queensland knew what happened to Daniel, and they were talking about his disappearance, which had been the goal of the media campaign. The story resonated with parents whose kids did the same thing that Daniel did. It could have been their children. So the entire state and later country stood very strong with the Morecambes and their hunt for Daniel and later justice. 5 days after his disappearance, vigils were held for Daniel at his school and at Siena Catholic College, where over 400 people attended. The family, although broken and desperate, were grateful for the love and support from the community. Again, this was important because it was covered by the media, and keeping Daniel's story out there was imperative, because it would mean that it would reach more people and maybe reach the right person who saw something that day that didn't seem important but could potentially break the case. And Queensland law enforcement did receive information from the public. In fact, the Daniel Morecambe case brought in the most tips that the state had ever received in one case, and still has, totaling over 14,000 pieces of information.
I mean, that's a lot. I mean, everyone's seeming to working together, so I mean, that's kind of, you know, you're going to find that to be the case.
Right. And now the difficult thing about this was the fact that that was a lot of pieces of information, and the fact that those pieces of information contradicted each other. So they had to do a lot of work in figuring out what was right and what wasn't. And that was very time consuming. Now, this is not to say that anyone intentionally gave bad information, but eyewitnesses are unreliable, especially when this case had been blasted out to the media. So people are hearing a lot of details regarding the case, and we know that that can change memories. So detectives really had to narrow down whether or not there had been one man or two men at the stop. And some people even reported that they had seen him at the Sunshine Plaza, but that was eventually ruled out when they found the child who it had actually been. The second route the investigation took was the boots-on-the-ground search for Daniel. Volunteers and police recruits from nearby Oxley Academy aided in the search. They extended the search to include aerial searches via helicopters and waterway searches that included dive teams. Each day, those searches turned up nothing, which became disheartening for the family. While the searches took place, investigators participated in a different kind of hunt. Interestingly enough, just 6 months prior, the Queensland Legislative Assembly had passed the Dangerous Prisoners Act in June of 2003. This was a list of sexual predators that were deemed, based on their crimes, a risk to the community after their prison sentence had been completed. So it's very similar to our sex offender registry.
Okay.
So this had just been enacted 6 months prior. So that's another reason why the Daniel Morecambe case is really big, because it's one of the first cases and definitely was the first high-profile case that is going to involve the Dangerous Prisoners Act. So in 2003, this was not made public, but it was a tool law enforcement had. So that's where there's a differentiation in 2003 from what our sex offenders list is versus what it was in the state of Queensland, because we have access to that list as citizens, but they do not. But we'll get there when it comes to the laws in Australia, because obviously it's a long time since 2003, as much as that hurts my heart, you know. So law enforcement has this list. So they worked off of the list and went to visit all the sex offenders that had been arrested previously to speak with them about the case that lived around the area or were connected to the area in any way.
In Queensland.
Well, Queensland is the whole state, but we're talking about like the area of Palm Woods. So that's where they're going to look first. But they're also going to look at anyone who is from Queensland who's associated with Palm Woods, but that doesn't necessarily live there.
Okay, got it.
This is what led them to a man named Douglas Jackway. Jackway seemed like a good suspect because not only did he possess a boxy, older model blue car, like the one that had reportedly been seen near the bus stop, he also had tattoos on his shoulder and calf, as well as a goatee, which had been the exact description of the man that people said they saw standing by the blue car.
Okay.
So they have a lot of questions for Mr. Jackway. Jackway had been imprisoned for abducting a boy by pulling him into his vehicle and sexually assaulting him, and had only been released a month before Daniel's disappearance. So he is looking like a very strong suspect. Because he lived an hour away from Palm Woods, the police would have to place him at the scene. Initially, he had lied to the police, but did eventually confess that he had been in the area of the Sunshine Coast on December 7th. His fiancée, I don't know how men find these women, told police when questioned that Jackway told her to provide him with an alibi and had threatened her if she didn't. So a warrant was obtained for Jackway's car to be searched for DNA. When this was told to him, it is stated in court records that he became violently upset. However, nothing was ever found in his car, and investigators, although he seemed like such a strong suspect, were forced to move on. However, they kept him on the back burner.
Okay. I just have a quick question.
Okay.
I understand that this act was enacted and people were put on the registry. I get all that. But are people going on the list once they've been found guilty of the crime, and that, or is it upon release?
It's upon release.
Okay. Now, they can only do that from 2003 forward.
No.
No?
No.
Okay, so they got people that are backlogged.
Right, like Jackway, who had been released, but this crime that he committed happened years prior.
The reason why I'm asking is because in my mind, when we found out there was no evidence in the car, I'm thinking, okay, is it a long shot here? But could we be dealing with somebody that is capable of such a heinous crime, but it goes so far back that it's not on the registry? Could that be a possibility?
Well, that's not going to be the case, because even though the act was signed and put into motion in June of 2003, it applies to all previous offenses.
Okay, got it. I just wanted to make sure, because like, imagine someone like that dodges that bullet.
I know.
Where they don't get put on the list because it was so long ago. Right. Where like, not to, I know hindsight's 20/20, but maybe somebody that like they were found guilty of it, but they got away with it and with a slap on the wrist.
Well, I know what you're saying. There's a difference between someone being convicted for something like that and someone getting away with it, especially when we're talking about someone who is going to be a victim of child sexual assault, especially a boy, because those statistics are very skewed in, well, I know in America, and I can only imagine in Australia as well, but victims of sexual abuse, period, do not come forward because of the shame. That happens twofold with children, especially male children. So, yeah, there's the conviction rate versus the offense rate is going to be a lot lower. So I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
So we think this person has done this before. We just don't know if they've been convicted of doing it before.
Right. I'm guessing that's part B to what I'm saying.
Yes.
You know, so it's there's a potentiality for that to be the case.
I was following where you were going
there. Yeah. Thank you for being on that journey with me.
You're welcome.
We got there.
Okay, guys, we're going to take a break here because we want to tell you about a podcast we think you'll love. If you like our show, try The Astonishing Dead Letter Office, a weekly spinoff from Scott and Forrest of Astonishing Legends. After 11 years of their deep research main show, they decided to start sharing listener stories that had piled up. Dead Letters covers everything from cryptids and ghosts to UFOs and strange encounters, so there's something for every spooky interest. Each episode, Scott and Forrest read a listener's letter, then discuss the experience, drawing on insights from over 300 episodes of their main show. Since launching, the Dead Letter Office quickly became a fan favorite, and new letters are now coming in daily. Episodes run about 35 to 45 minutes, perfect for a road trip, errands, or a late night listen. And they release every Tuesday. The Dead Letter Office is included in the Astonishing Legends feed and already has a year's worth of episodes to catch up on. To listen, subscribe to Astonishing Legends wherever you get podcasts, or visit astonishinglegends.com. The Dead Letter Office comes through the main feed weekly. Okay, let's get back to the show. So that brings us to December 19th, 2003. 12 days into the search, and the birthday of Daniel and his twin brother Bradley, who was forced to, for the first time in his life, celebrate his birthday without his twin.
That's so sad.
It was very hard for the Morecambes to come to terms with what they were suffering through. But I have to say, in all of the footage of Bruce, Denise, Bradley, and Dean, they are resolute and hopeful, which is a testament to their strength and the good upbringing they provided for their sons. But underneath, in their eyes, you can see a glimpse into the utter devastation Daniel's disappearance had caused. The sergeant at the time of Daniel's disappearance said that she, the family, and two priests from the family's church were at the table, celebrating, or trying to, what would have been Daniel's 14th birthday. As was tradition, the three baptism candles of the Morecambe boys were lit. And as they talked about Daniel, one of the flames blew out. The sergeant reflected that it was a very powerful moment for the family because it spoke to what they feared the most, that Daniel was dead and that they would never get him back. Bruce and Denise created the Daniel Morecambe Foundation because of all the donations that poured in from around the country. In the beginning, they wanted to properly channel the money through the foundation and not themselves, so the focus would only be on bringing Daniel home. The foundation printed and distributed missing posters, paid for billboards, and the wrapping of a tractor trailer, which belonged to a gracious volunteer that drove the length of the Sunshine Coast as his route, and he wanted to help spread the word of the abduction and case details as they were printed on his trailer.
That's very nice of that man.
Yeah. And there was also radio and television ads that aired to reach more people. And there were also songs associated with the disappearance of Daniel. Like, this was a movement to find him. That's the best way to explain it. Police aided in the spread of information. And those who lived there at the time said that the information was everywhere. Daniel's pictures, the sketches of the two men that had possibly been at the bus stop, the description of the blue car and white van that were also potentially there. They were on billboards, bumper stickers, pizza boxes. Everywhere you looked, you saw. Everyone was urged to call in, and everyone that had seen anything did. But their information led investigators nowhere, except knowing that Daniel had most likely met a terrible fate. Over time, the investigation into Daniel's disappearance became as weather-worn and faded as the red ribbons that adorned the overpass where he had last been seen. Months turned to years, and collectively the hearts of Queensland broke for the Morecambe family. The foundation created in Daniel's name shifted from just funding the spread of information about the case to the education of children in Australia about child safety and vigilance from abductions. But although the investigation had slowed, it never stopped. By December 2005, the reward for any information that led to the discovery of Daniel had reached, through private and state donations, $1 million Australian dollars. In interviews, his family, still broken by their son's disappearance, admitted that they thought their son and brother was dead. But they still needed to find him and bring to justice the person that had stolen his life. Movement on the case would come 6 years later, in 2011, when Daniel's family took action. They appealed to the Queensland Coroner's Court, which is a government body responsible for investigating reportable deaths that involve public safety concerns. Bruce explained that they were very matter of a fact in their letter. This happened to our son. It's in the public interest of the state that the person responsible be found, as they may offend again. So they requested all potential suspects, or the suspects that had been questioned by the police, be questioned again, but in court, in the coroner's court, under oath, in hopes that they would be more truthful because there was legal ramifications for lying.
That's very interesting. I never heard. Obviously, that's a must be an Australian thing.
Yes, laws are different there. Okay. But the family at this point felt like law enforcement, although came out swinging in the investigation, that as the years passed, they felt were dragging their feet. So they were like, we're not going to sit around. Like, what can we do? What are our legal options? And that's why they applied to the coroner's court. And they couldn't be denied because, yeah, it is in public interest for this person to be caught. Because look at what they did to Daniel. I mean, he was abducted on a busy highway.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it is in the best interest of the community. And I get the feeling that the community really hasn't forgotten, which I find that to be, I don't want to say rare, but I do find that that's a very good thing for the family.
Yes.
Because how bad would it be if you just kind of, you know, Daniel's memory just kind of just goes to like a forgotten place?
Well, that happens with a lot of missing children. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that the fact that there was such a high profile, large media presence about his disappearance, he kind of became Australia's child that went missing, you know, and everybody connected with the case. So because of that connection everyone had, it made it almost impossible for the courts not to react and accept the request.
Okay, well, that's good. I mean, that's something.
Now, but this would mean a lot of people would have to be questioned under oath, as in total, 20,000 tips had come in and over 10,000 interviews with potential subjects had been conducted in the past 8 years. But the police provided a list of their viable suspects, which did include all of the known pedophiles from the list that they had based on that 2003 law that they had.
I mean, that is a lot of people to, you know, to bring under.
Well, it's not going to be all 10,000. They're going to give a shorter list of people that they believe are viable suspects based off of those 10,000 interviews.
Right. So they're going to break it down. They're going to weed out people that they don't think have anything to do with it.
Right. Okay. There were like 36 people that were interviewed by the coroner's court. And Bruce and Denise were present for all of it. One of the known sex offenders that had been questioned was named Brett Peter Cowan. Cowan had, without a doubt, earned his spot on that list. So I'm going to get into the past crimes of Peter Cowan. If this is something that you don't want to hear, I suggest you fast forward about 5 minutes because this man is prolific in the crimes he committed. In 1987, when Cowan was 18 years old, he had been arrested for theft and drug offenses. He was sentenced to community service around a child care center where he was to perform maintenance duties. So basically, he was at a public park, which was near where this child care center was located, and the children would go into the park. He took a 7-year-old child from the park and brought him into a bathroom where he sexually assaulted the boy in a bathroom stall. Afterwards, he was reportedly calm and acted as if nothing happened. And this was, of course, the people that were serving community service with him. This is from their interviews. In 1989, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison for that crime. But of those 2 years, he only served one. In 1993, he offended again, and his violence escalated. Near where he lived, in a caravan park in Darwin, Cowan lured a 6-year-old boy into an abandoned car yard. He took the boy into an abandoned car and savagely sexually assaulted him. When hours later the dazed boy stumbled into a gas station, dazed and confused, people initially thought he had been hit by a car. His wounds were so extensive. During the brutality of the act, the boy was cut and his lung punctured by a rib. During the investigation, the boy's discarded underwear was found at the scene. They were able to get DNA evidence from the semen left on that pair of underwear. Every male at the caravan park volunteered their DNA to investigators, except Cowan, who made a big show of his questioning, saying to police, "I hope you catch the bastard." They looked into his past, and during his next questioning session with them, they confronted him with the fact that he had been sent to prison for a similar crime. And feeling like he was caught, especially because of the DNA evidence, he confessed that it had been him who had assaulted the boy.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, during his trial for that case, the more serious charge of attempted murder was dropped because it would have been hard to prove. So he was sentenced to 7 years in 1994. However, the sentence was later reduced to 3.5 years. During his time in prison, Cowan was psychologically assessed, and what they found was incredibly troubling. The psychologist reported that Cowan lived a parasitic existence, living off people, especially his parents, and he had been able to do so because he was a practiced and talented pathological liar. He also had a gross lack of awareness, empathy, or remorse, having once told the evaluator that he had not believed that his victim would have reported the attack, meaning the boy from the caravan park, because he believed the six-year-old boy probably enjoyed the experience.
Okay, I can't even hear that. That is wild.
He is sick.
This guy is insane.
And if anyone is a danger to the community, it's this man.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Cowan was released from prison in 1997.
That's crazy.
His sentence was reduced to 3.5 years, so he served it.
Right, but how can you think that this guy won't go out and do this again? From 1987 to 1989 to 93 now, he's done things
right
that are unspeakable. Like, yes, the worst crimes you could ever do.
Mm-hmm.
And you think this guy, especially since he's been a quote-unquote evaluated, like, yeah. I'm actually pissed. Because nobody in any kind of center or prison or whatever he's in maybe just has that thought, you know what? He'll reoffend again. We need to put this in front of like some kind of parole board or however they mm-hmm. do it there. This guy should never come out because he'll just hurt other children and destroy them and other families as well.
Right. I completely agree with you, because the problem here now in 1997 is, so you want to wait for a third child to get assaulted by him.
Right.
Or potentially murdered by him,
mm-hmm.
in order for you to be able to put him away for a longer time and maybe not to serve prison time, but to go to an institute where he needs to be.
Absolutely. Like, listen, I don't know what else you need to see.
Well,
because I find that people like that who are doing what he's doing, I know this is going to sound bad, but I feel like at some point it's like, I don't want them to reoffend again. So it's like, we should throw the book at them so hard that they don't have a leg to stand on. At what point do they have the right to do that?
You can't recover from what they do.
Right. It's so egregious.
Yeah.
I understand everyone has rights, but I feel like when you've been convicted and put away for crimes like this multiple times, I feel like mm-hmm. you should not have that right.
Well, I think there's a difference between certain crimes that are committed, like robbery, maybe breaking and entering, and you've committed those crimes there's a multitude of reasons why someone would commit a crime like that. And, you know, they range from someone being callous, a psychopath, to maybe someone being in a bad socioeconomic place. So those crimes, I think, given the right treatment in a proper situation, whether it's a prison situation or an institution situation, someone could potentially be rehabilitated from. But when you take a look at this man or men or women who offend because there's something wrong with them that stops them from feeling empathy, and also it's a sexual perversion that they have, that's never going to be cured.
No, and it's evident based on the fact that he's in an environment where he is locked away, and that is not
good. So he's building up
right.
this aggression.
And it's also not, it's also teaching him that it doesn't matter. I can do what I did to the 6-year-old child and be told it's a 7-year sentence, but I get out in 2 or 3 or whatever.
No, or next time he goes, I have to take care of the
right.
witness.
Or that. And then there's an escalation in mm-hmm. his crime. So there's no rehabilitation. There's no environment where he could actually be a normal member of society. I'm sorry, but I believe the book should be thrown and he should never come out again.
I think we're both in agreement that the sentences for crimes like that should be a little bit more extensive.
Yeah. By the
a
way,
lot more extensive.
By the way, I'm sorry. This one's just got me really heated because it is so disgusting. It is.
Well, John, you think everyone doesn't feel the same exact way?
I know. Well, right but now? I know, but you know what? I'm speaking for those people because right. honestly, it is disgusting. We both know it.
Yeah. You can only imagine how hard this was to write. So Cowan was released from prison in 1997. He was ordered to attend a sexual offenders treatment program and moved in with his aunt and uncle. His aunt was a pastor at a Reformed Christian church, and he was said to have thrown himself into the church community. He met and married a churchgoer, and the couple moved to Birwa, which is located about 25 minutes south of the abduction site. There, the couple had 2 children.
Oh my God.
She had children with this man. She believed him to be rehabilitated because of his relationship now with God and Jesus Christ. During this time, there was no criminal charges brought against Cowan, nor was he suspected of any. He did regularly attend church, but again, we don't know if this just, he committed crimes and they just weren't reported. That we don't know about. However, interestingly enough, during 2003, around the time when Daniel Morecambe was abducted, Cowan reportedly stopped attending church, and the couple got divorced in 2004, very shortly after Daniel's abduction.
And I'm going to tell you right now, even if we were to say that he tried to, you know, find himself anew in mm-hmm. religion, that might have potentially worked for a short time, but then this might have been the trigger for
Correct.
Him to do what he has always done.
Right. He obviously doesn't seem like the kind of man that can hold a long-term stable relationship with a woman or with a family. So that probably went south. The couple was headed towards divorce. He stops going to church. His facade falls, or what he was, the crutch he was leaning on to help him not reoffend, falls. This is a trigger situation
right.
that we hear about all the time. And now, not to necessarily even say that he needs a trigger event, it could be the opposite. He could have been itching to reoffend, and then that's why his marriage fell apart, and that's why he stopped going to church. So, you know. We don't want to put the cart before the horse. We don't want to assume which came first.
Right.
But something happened in his life, whether it was the itch to reoffend or a trigger event. And that happened right around the time Daniel went missing. So as you can imagine, this man is totally going to be questioned during the coroner's inquiry. And I think a larger question is, why didn't the police look at this more?
I mean, then it kind of goes hand in hand with the whole thing where the family felt like they were dragging their feet. Maybe not initially, but like you said earlier, but, you know, throughout the trying to find where he even is, mm-hmm. what's going on, I think they might have been dragging their feet.
Right. Well, back in 2003, Cowan had been questioned about Daniel's abduction, and the entire interview was filmed.
At one point, investigators asked him if he would have told them if he took Daniel, and he said, no, probably not. Investigators admitted to having been suspicious of Cowan because he did eventually tell them that he had been in the area of Palm Woods the day that Daniel went missing. He said he had been there because he needed to pick up a mulcher that he had purchased. And in order to get from Birwa to the location of the pickup, he would have had to pass the bus stop that Daniel waited at.
So this person's a perfect candidate in every aspect. And nothing was really followed up with him, I'm guessing.
No.
That's wild.
Cowan was never cleared, but also never further investigated.
I don't understand that. I don't.
On the stand under oath, a different story came out, though. Cowan confessed that he had actually been in the area not to pick up a mulcher, but to meet a drug dealer, something he had lied to them about previously. This is also an important detail because during his other crimes against children, Cowan had also been using drugs. So we know that he was separating from his wife. He stopped going to church. He was using drugs again. And then Daniel goes missing.
Could this be a ploy, though, to take away from the more serious crime of what he could potentially have been, that he did here by saying, hey, listen, I was there. I was trying to get drugs.
Like, I was being a little shady.
Right. It's making him look like I'm doing something bad, but I'm not doing what you think I did.
No, I understand what you're saying, but that's not what's happening here.
Okay.
I think he's scared because of his past offenses to lie under the coroner's inquiry because he doesn't know if they have found his drug dealer.
I see what you're saying.
So I think he's just forced into telling the truth here.
So in a way, the family's plea for this trial actually seems to possibly work in his favor.
Well,
in their favor, sorry.
Well, Denise said that while Brett Cowan was questioned under oath and he denied abducting Daniel, she leaned over to her husband and whispered, Jesus, that's him.
Wow.
Like, they knew right away.
That's powerful.
And when Cowan finished on the stand, he walked back to his place in the courtroom, which was just 2 meters away from where Daniel's parents were. They watched him the whole way. And when he sat down, he looked at them, their eyes all locking for the first time. And he smiled.
I would jump over that pew or whatever the hell it was. Oh, especially if I had that feeling that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, I don't know how I'd control myself.
Well, Bruce has talked a lot of times about trying and it being really hard to contain his anger, his rage, and then trying to like channel it through positive ways in which they could find Daniel. But he says it's very difficult for him to do that, well, as you can imagine.
He's a strong man then. Because I don't know how I would be able to be normal.
Yeah, I know.
Especially, and also right now we're talking like this, but we don't even know where his body is. We don't even know where he is or what's happened.
Right.
So like, this is just them having a feeling that it's him.
Yes. Well, it was pretty obvious given his past, life circumstances, the lies about his location and purpose to be at the location on December 7th, and his demeanor in the courtroom, that Cowan was a very viable suspect. And that really was the whole reason why this inquest was happening. They didn't think, okay, we're going to find out during this inquest what went down. They just wanted to get everyone re-questioned, but in public, because maybe other witnesses would come forward because a lot of media attention was around this. Detectives would look into people that were a little bit more viable. Did anyone's story change? Was anyone not consistent? So they wanted to reinvigorate the investigation and they did so, but like it seemed like red flag, huge flares going up. It's this guy.
Yeah, and I think that the best way to do that too is by getting the public's re-interest into, hey, like, you know, my son's still missing. You know, we need to set a fire under this investigation, you know, all these people's asses, if I'm speaking frank.
And to be honest, the police were really eager to act because they were, I don't know, for lack of a better term, a bit embarrassed because they had been bested by him 8 years prior and they kind of stopped that investigation. So they were very aggressively going to try and take Cowan down. And a massive operation began in which they would best Cowan by using his biggest weakness against him.
Okay.
The fact that he thought himself an invincible criminal mastermind. They needed to get him to confess, so they set up an undercover sting to do so. It all started on Cowan's flight back to Perth, where he lived at the time of the inquest. There sat an undercover officer right next to Cowan, who worked hard to befriend him. And by the end of the flight, this man believed that his seat neighbor was part of a powerful criminal organization, mafia style, that was interested in making him a member because he had what it took.
You got to be kidding me, right?
No. Okay. Well, because he wants to hear this about himself because true. He believes it of himself.
That's true.
This is like a twisted version of like, you're a wizard, Harry, and he ate it all up, you know?
I'm sorry. You just used the wizard Harry part. That's why I'm laughing. But okay. Well,
it's true because he's like, oh, of course this criminal gang would love to have me. I knew I was special all along. I'm so good at what I do. So after months of having Cowan participate in activities with this quote-unquote gang, who were in reality all police officers, they convinced him that the big boss was impressed by him and wanted to offer him a position of leadership within their organization. And for context, some of the things this gang did or got involved with was drugs, diamond smuggling, and prostitution, all of which never happened, but they made it look like it was. Cowan was all in and honored at the fact that they wanted to put him in a position of leadership and excited about all the power and money that would come from it.
This is crazy. Mm-hmm. This sting part should be a movie.
Oh, yes.
Wild.
So they convince him that in order to get this position, he has to be vetted by the big boss and cleaned of former crimes. So those crimes cannot come back and harm the organization.
Oh, they were smart.
Mm-hmm. So his interview was all set up with the boss, who they referred to as Mr. Big, which like LOL, because I can only think of Sex and the City, right? And this happens at the Hyatt Hotel in Perth. Cowan was brought up to the room by one of the associates, another police officer, and he was basically foaming at the mouth. He was so excited. But little did he know that the entire hotel room was bugged and cameras were set up. And the next room was filled with police officers and detectives with the listening and viewing equipment.
Oh, this is awesome. Okay.
So Cowan was told he had to be honest and confess his crimes to the boss, because the boss would appreciate the honesty and help him clean anything up. So in the room, the boss, who was an undercover detective, said to Cowan, "Do you know what you're up for?" And Cowan said, "Yes." The conversation of the murder of Daniel Morecambe came up because Cowan had been accused of it. He had to go to the inquest and he had been questioned under oath about it. And the boss said to Cowan, "If I've got to postpone what we're going to do for a few months to sort this out, I'm happy to do it for your sake, all right? Because I'm told that you're pretty loyal and you've built up a good relationship with some of the boys, and they speak highly of you." Cowan said that he appreciated that. And the boss said, "So what do I need to fix?" And finally, Cowan said, "Okay, you know, yeah, I did it." He confessed, and the investigators in the room next door all breathed a sigh of relief. They were on the right track, But the detective in the room with Cowan knew that he needed to get more from him. So he pressed. So the detective said, all right, so you did it. So the detective slash Mr. Big here said, all right, so you did it. So what I'm saying is I need to sit you right back to the whole thing so that if there's anything like, you know, that they've got any DNA or that kind of shit, obviously they haven't found the boy. So he's trying to make Cowan remember or reveal any possible evidence that may exist or would have left, he would have left behind to prove that he committed the crime.
Okay, I like what this detective is thinking. Because
he has to clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
So when Cowan couldn't think, he said, okay, tell me everything that happened that day. And Cowan went on to describe his day. Like, he is just hook, line, and sinker in here. So he described how he had seen Daniel on the highway waiting for the bus. He said he parked his white four-wheel drive vehicle, so this is the white van that everybody saw, nearby, and he pretended to be waiting for the bus, too. The undercover officer asked him if he had spoken with Daniel for long, and he said, no, I didn't speak to him at all. I just waited behind him. He was the man propped up under the underpass.
Wow. So they were right. So the eyewitness in this the eyewitnesses in this case were right.
Spot on. Like, even the way he was leaning against the overpass.
Overpass and the car as well. Mm-hmm.
So Cowan said that when the replacement bus passed and didn't stop for Daniel, he took his opportunity. And this is exactly what the detective thought happened.
Yeah.
He approached the boy and said, I'm going to the shopping center. Do you want a lift? And Daniel said, yep. And got into the car with him.
Oh,
I know.
That's so sad.
He just trusted him.
Right.
Because he was good at manipulation and he was a pathological liar and it was the way he played it. He had done this before. And Daniel didn't stand a chance. I think even if he would have said no, he would have become a victim.
I agree.
I think he had been spotted by Cowan and the decision was made before he even approached Daniel when that bus passed. He said he then drove Daniel to an abandoned demountable house located at Lot 2, 510 Kings Road in Glasshouse Mountains, which was near Birwa, where he lived with his family at the time. Cowan said to the undercover officer, who he thought was a mob boss, I never got to molest him or anything like that. He panicked and I panicked and I grabbed him around the throat. And just before I knew it, he was dead. Now, we'll get into whether or not that's the truth. I think, based on further evidence we're going to see a little bit later on, that he's lying here, but he knows that, you know, that's not, criminals are smart. They know the kind of criminals they are around, so they'll fit themselves to be around those criminals. He knows this mob boss and the other guys he's been hanging around, that's not their predilection, the sexual abuse of children. So he's going to deny it to this guy because he knows that guy doesn't do that.
Right.
And that's then, what I think happened there.
Yeah, that's his play, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So he said he disposed of Daniel's body at a different location. He drove to some nearby bushland and picked up his body and threw him over an embankment and then went down there and dragged him further from the road. He said it was there that he took off his clothes and covered him with branches and leaves. He took the boy's clothes with him and threw them in a creek later. The undercover detective said that he was nervous that there was still DNA evidence even after all this time had passed. So he wanted Cowan to fly back to Queensland to reveal the murder and dumping site so they could get rid of any trace evidence. And he agreed to go.
Oh, my God. They got this guy.
Oh, yeah.
They got this guy.
So Cowan took his mob associates, aka undercover police officers, to Queensland and recreated the entire crime for them, taking them to the bus stop, the demountable house, and the location where he left Daniel's body. He explained that back in 2003, he had scrubbed the tracks from around the demountable house so he couldn't be traced back to the scene. And when he went back to the site where he had left Daniel's body the following day, on December 8, 2003, he found that most of Daniel's remains had been taken by animals, but a piece of his skull had been left behind. So he smashed it with a shovel that he had brought with him because he thought he was going to have to bury the body. Once he finished with his reenactment, he was arrested and charged with the murder of Daniel Morecambe.
Good. That's crazy. I mean, the lengths that they went to go to get him, though, in the end, made up for them dragging their feet.
Well, that's kind of what Daniel's family are going to say. They were definitely not happy with the investigation. And of course, they're going to be furious with the fact that they had this guy back in 2003 in this interview. But they do say that they very much appreciate the actions of these undercover detectives because they had to be undercover for months. The work they did was extensive. They were away from their families. And actually, that undercover detective that had posed as the big boss, he actually works a lot and is a huge part of the Daniel Morecambe Foundation now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, as the site of the murder was in Mumbai, they, and I hope I'm saying all these towns right. I'm sorry, guys. I live in the United States. It's hard. And I have a New Jersey accent, which destroys me and everything I do.
You're doing great. You're doing great. Thanks.
Well, you think so. I don't know. Well, listen,
if I was to do it, it would be botched 10 times worse.
That's true. So because that's where the murder site was in Mumbai, that is where Cowan was officially charged with murder, deprivation of liberty, child stealing, indecent treatment of a child under 16, and interfering with a corpse. So those are his official charges. A search of the area where he said he had left Daniel revealed the boy's shoes and bones that were later proven to be his. The family and many others involved in the case do not believe the version of events that Cowan expressed to the undercover officers. Like I said before, he was dealing with men who did not think the way he did, or he didn't perceive that they did. Not all criminals are child predators, and most of them don't take to that behavior. So they think that he brushed past it. And this theory is supported by evidence that they know that Daniel's clothes had been removed in the demountable house because fibers that were found within the house were found on his body that couldn't have been in that location unless his clothing had been removed.
Okay. Yeah.
So unfortunately, they think that he was sexually assaulted by him. But that has not been proven. After his trial, Brett Peter Cowan was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 20 years. He was also sentenced to 3.5 years for imprisonment and indecently dealing with Daniel, and 2 years for interfering with his corpse. The judge wanted her statement to be on the record. She said, "I do not think you should be released in 20 years' time." Cowan will not be eligible for parole until 2031. In August of 2016, a prisoner serving time with Cowan dumped a mop bucket of boiling water on his head and hit him with the bucket in the head 3 to 4 times. When questioned about the incident, he said, "I did it, no one else, just me." He had it coming, and that he did. So for that little bit of retribution, he wanted him to feel, the man who committed this crime against Cowan said that he wanted Cowan to feel some kind of pain like his victims felt, but it could be nothing compared to what he did to his victims. The man who was already serving a long amount of time had time served concurrently, So he really didn't get more time for the crime that he committed against Cowan. But his acts of vigilante justice, of course, were condemned by the courts, but like he really didn't get anything. Well, Daniel's family works with his foundation to do many wonderful things for Australia. In 2021, they helped pass tougher parole laws in Queensland for child killers. And in 2025, they helped advocate with the Queensland Parliament to have passed Daniel's Law, which is the state's first public child sex offender registry that works with a three-tiered system, very similar to the system that we have here.
Okay.
It is to be reviewed in a final report later this month, actually. So we should find out very soon because we're recording this on Halloween, by the way. Happy yes. Halloween, guys.
Well, I support that because I think it should be public knowledge.
Right.
Yeah.
And the family hopes that it will take effect. The Daniel Morecambe Foundation has also worked with the Queensland Education Department to develop a child safety curriculum that is available for use in every school in the country, with videos and resources added frequently. They also raise awareness on the last Friday of every October, so today. The day is known as the Day for Daniel, where children are taught the curriculum and encouraged to wear red as remembrance of a life that was stolen 22 years ago, but a crime that could have happened to any one of them.
It's very true. You know, I've said this about other families that do this, but I think they really do deserve me saying that though your tragedy is unspeakable, there's no words to make, you know, to make them feel better or anything like that. But all I can say is I'm glad, though, that they got answers and that they poured all their efforts into making sure that this doesn't happen to other families.
Right. And I think that's a really admirable thing because they're going out of their way to, even though it must be incredibly painful to relive this over and over again, they've probably saved the lives of a lot of children.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes it does take, which it shouldn't, but sometimes it does take organizations like theirs to make significant change, you know, making things public and training. I mean, I wish that it wouldn't come down to this, but I'm glad that these organizations do exist and we should support them.
Right. We usually see proactivity in things like this, whether it be, unfortunately, child abduction or drunk driving or something like that, come from foundations that start from families who have lost children because of it. And it's just sad that this case ended the way that it did. And although the statistics were not in their favor, you always hope for the families of abducted children because you want them, although it's so rare, to have that happy ending. And I think that, you know, that candle being blown out on Daniel's 14th birthday really did signify to them that his life was over, but that they would continue his legacy.
Yeah, I agree. And well said, babe. I feel so bad for them.
I know. This one is
this one's bad.
Gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
And we really are eager to hear what you have to say about this case. So if you are following along on Patreon, why we want to hear what you have to say, or if it's on Instagram, leave us a comment under this episode. But before we go, what we want to do is we want to say thank you to all of the new people who have become patrons of the podcast on Patreon. So we want to say a big thank you to Joshua Jones, Foxy Lady, Ava Esposito, Jessica Wilcox, Laura Copeland, Rachel Ramsey, Jessica Marino, Lindsay Lemon, Vallis, Daisy Hong, Deckers Wendy, Liz, Kimberly Henry, and this listener. Ready?
I'm ready.
Yes, John, you sexy man is their name.
Oh.
So maybe that's, I don't know if that's them or that's you. We don't know.
Oh, wow. Don't make me blush.
Jennifer Bartholomew, Kat Harton, Parithi Chandra, Dina Kupchak, Richard Guff, Kelly Raitt, Samantha Moran, Christiane Staten, Meddy, Kiara Lamb, Karen McCormick, Colleen Harrington Messenholder, Lauren Shirley, Kelsey, Charlotte Powers, Rebecca Nelson, Nikki Morton, Wendy Wallace, and Laura Shivers. Thanks, guys. We hope you're enjoying the extra episodes. And until next time, don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
COTA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.